You're listening to Gilder 4 Radio, broadcasting live across the swamp, the hive, outlands, and the far reaches of the Ash Wave.
Hey everyone, welcome to Gildersford Radio, broadcasting live deep from the heart of Gildersford's notorious Eastgate Docks. I'm Lee, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Dixie, Roscoe, Lawrence and Gaz. GFR is back. All the news is unimproved by Lord Helmar and his goons, the worst-smelling goons in the Underhive. Hello there, friends. Well, it's been a bit of a mixed bag here in Gildersford the past month. Roscoe ran one of his one-off intro games where we all went snake hunting in the depths of the sump. But of course, this was before the rules for boats were officially announced, so we all got a little wet, and some of us got eaten. We're all fantastically excited for the new rules that have been announced, and are a little envious of those who get to see them early. Nevertheless, we'll be discussing our hot takes on some of these. We're going to be doing a sneaky peek into Dixie's next campaign, where we're going back to basics. Yes, forget your fancy weapons, or stacks of whack. This is all about picking up that trusty old 2x4 and getting to work. This month we're also joined by another special guest, and we'll be discussing brand new players to both Necromunda and to Gildersford, getting into the game and diving into the lore. It's another packed episode, so stop fretting that your new rulebooks won't get delivered on time and join us. Well, it's that time of the month again. We're very happy to have you all along, dear listeners. It's time to introduce everyone. Say hello, Dixie.
Good evening.
Say hello, Gaz.
Bonjour.
Say hello, Lee. Hello, Lee. Unfortunately, Lawrence and Ross can't be with us tonight. It's the summertime and the little Skyvers are on vacation, so we're going to soldier on. But once again, we are joined by another special guest. Say hello, Cal.
Hello.
So Cal is a very new player to both Necromunda and Gildersford, and we've got some really kind of interesting topics this week that connect directly to that fresh kind of perspective that I think a lot of people will find interesting. So, but on the flip side of that, it's Episode 10, gents. You know, 10 months ago. Is that like, how impressive is that? We've been doing this for 10 months. We started GFR, and we want to say a big thank you to all the listeners from around the world. We do shout-outs to everyone, especially our subscribers, but it will take way too long. But I'm fascinated where everyone dials in. I think we all are. We all look at the stats from Buzzsprout, and we're kind of fascinated who dials in, especially those super early morning listeners on the west coast of the US and late night listeners on the east coast of Australia. Serious props for everyone who's listening, contributing, and subscribing.
It's really encouraging.
Well, absolutely. So this month, well, actually, when I wrote the notes to the intro spiel for this, it had been a pretty quiet month for Necromunda, and then all of a sudden it just exploded. We've got new rules coming out, we've got a new Apocrypha, we've got some new models, so we've got lots of stuff to talk about tonight, gents. Are we excited about that?
Buzzing. Absolutely buzzing.
Always excited to talk Necromunda.
Yes, absolutely. No, but reading, and we have to say up front a big thank you to, obviously, to Goonhammer. And who else was doing? I read the Goonhammer thing. I thought that was phenomenal. I know Sump City have done their breakdown of the rules.
Yeah, I listened to that. I think Battle Bunnies did an article as well.
Yeah.
GMG Review. Oh, yes, Spruce and Brews.
Spruce and Brews, that's right.
GMG Reviews is a great one if you want to check out the YouTube video and see pages of the book.
We are not yet one of the select few that gets the rules, so we are going to be relying very heavily on Goonhammer. I will be relying on the Goonhammer article especially, so thank you for that, gents. It was much appreciated to give us the heads up about what's happening, and there's lots of stuff I'm super excited for, but we'll get to that later. So the first topic we're going to start with tonight is, as Cal's here, and as a brand new player to Necromunda, when did you start, Cal? When, you know, you sort of joined the club very recently, Gildersford and us, so give us a little bit of a breakdown about your kind of intro, how you found Necromunda, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then we really want to dive into, you know, as a completely brand spanking new player, not only the Necromunda lore, but the Gildersford lore, and how you kind of, how you're getting an in into that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I've been hobbying for, goodness, about 20 years. Not my first rodeo in the 40k universe. I did have a bit of a hiatus and back
don't
into class, kind of. You're right. I thought I was too cool for it, and then realised actually it's the definition of cool. About 5-6 years ago, I dipped back into it. But it was at Salute this year. I met up with a really good friend of mine, David and Adam from from the Watford club, and he pointed me towards the Guildersford Radio, and I thought, do you know what? Let's dip in. Let's
take Mr. Whack himself.
Adam for sending you our way.
Exactly. Yeah. So he said, look, you know, the Guildford Games Club's relatively close to me. I've always dabbled a little bit. David used to get me into a bit of Inquisimunda, some kind of local community rules, you know, that type of stuff. And said, no, go check this out. So I binge listened to GFR.
I'm sure that wasn't probably sensible.
Hooked. I feel like I completed it, which was really good. So did the first six or seven episodes kind of back to back, pretty much. I was doing a bit of work travel, and then reached out to you guys and swung past. And I think the rest is history. So about a couple of months now, I've been dipping in, and first couple of minis painted for my Escher gang. So yeah.
Welcome aboard. I know you've had you had an intro game, and then a couple of weeks ago we had like the one-off game that had Ross been here we would have been talking about, but you know, we're not. Anyway, we'll save that for when he's back. But you had the intro, the special game that he set up. So how are you finding that?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely fantastic. I think the rule set is just so different to anything else, isn't it? You know, I mean, I still think it's pretty funny. You guys must look at me sometimes. I'm looking at kind of the different dice going, which dice do I need to pick up now?
Oh, don't worry about that. Everyone does that.
Right? So yeah, it's so different, but it just feels, as a rule set, quite neat. You know, yes, there's a hell of a lot of detail, and the more you look, the more you find. But actually, kind of, you know, in terms of your admin, you know, what you've got on the table, it's relatively straightforward. It's relatively streamlined.
That's an interesting take.
Yeah,
I think we'll get some controversial opinions on that, I'm sure.
I have no doubt. But then again, you know, being fresh into it, I only know what I know, right?
So just to back up on that a second, so I was going to say, what game systems? I mean, obviously, there's some 40K. I'm assuming, but what other game systems are you used to playing that means you think Necromunda's easy to use on the tabletop?
Yeah, so I've dabbled a bit in Flames of War. I've done a bit of X-Wing. I've done a bit of Age of Sigmar. Played the original the OG Warhammer. So kind of dabbled in all of, you know, kind of all of those sets in the main. Not done too much historical stuff other than Flames of War, but kind of done a few trial games. And I think I just think it's the way that the rules are kind of laid out for Necromunda that just make it pretty. The actual base framework I find relatively straightforward, picking up. But then what's really quite exciting is then the depth behind that. You know, and I think I'm quickly realizing it's relatively simple and streamlined for kind of what you know and what you need to pick up the dice and get some figures moving around the board. But actually, the exciting thing is the more you, like I say, the more you find, the more you look, the more you find. You know, which is quite cool. So.
Oh, I like that.
I think I'd agree with that assessment as someone that's come back to the hobby after a long hiatus as well. I think that the core rule set is tight and the basic principles of it are relatively simple to follow. I think it's just like you say, the more you dig into it, the more intricate and the more options there are. And I think that's where some people's confusion comes from.
Yeah, we've touched on that before, haven't we, around how much or little you add to your games, basically.
Precisely.
There's so much out there now. We'll come back to that when we talk about our next couple
what
of
we're
subjects.
Doing. I mean, I personally love that because I, even though I'm playing 10th edition 40K and I've played some Sigmar, in my opinion, the lobotomization of those, I mean, I've been playing, you know, 40K since first edition and I think, you know, 5th and 6th were probably the best editions. People, you know, can argue about that, whatever version. But we're going to simplify the rules and it's like four pages and then there's all, and I just think it's just the lobotomization of the game. And actually to have a new person come in to what a lot of people would argue would be a fairly dense rule set that include old templates and scatter dice and all kinds of tables to look up and actually say it's actually relatively straightforward is like, yeah, it is. And it doesn't need any more simplification. And the lobotomization of the other games is a bad move in my call.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I can cover more of this point kind of, you know, in a minute, but it very much depends who you're playing with as well, right? I have played played some friendly games before that really haven't felt friendly. In the past, you know, huge self-imposed pressure to make sure you've got a handle on all the, you know, all the detail of the rules. You know, you're proficient, you're fast, you're making quick decisions. You know, and again, maybe this is my issue, but you end up putting quite a lot of pressure on yourself to uphold that.
For 40K, you mean?
Yeah, but particularly for 40K, particularly for what I've played for Age of Sigmar as well. You know, played a little bit of that, and God, the pressure was like playing Master Chess, you know, which was...
I think that, depending on, again, who you're playing, I think right. That's the tournament scene coming out. And I think that's the reason of all the ill and the woe of those games, that they're pandering to the tournament players.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right, you know, and I think that's what's so nice about the narrative RPG type style with Necromunda, is that actually I can get kind of a grip of the framework of the rules, come to the table, and actually it's just like-minded people just having a laugh on an evening. And yep. if I don't know the detail, no sweat, like people will fill in that for me, you know, people will point me to the right dice to use, right, you know, so it just feels much more relaxed, much more simple. And actually, you know, lots of rules out and stuff, you know, over the last couple of days, and it just feels as though I can now get as deep into Necromunda in my own pace, without that pressure, which is really, really quite nice.
You just have to make sure that your two fighters don't immediately get eaten by a giant snake.
And pretty much spend the whole evening inside the snake's stomach.
Trying to crawl out.
Exactly. Every round. But great fun.
What was the plural that Ross was using? You were trying to Boba Fett it or something like that. Or Fett it. I can't, you know. But basically, the idea, listeners, was that the fighters were being eaten by this sump creature, and just like Boba Fett crawling out of the Sarlacc, he was, you know, sort of trying to get people to do that. And count. Every single game was every single turn was going roll. No, I'm going to get out. Roll. No, I'm not getting out. Roll. I'm not getting out.
Yeah. Excellent. Which was hilarious in itself, right? You know. But yeah, that's a type of fun I don't think you get with other rule sets. You know, which is quite cool.
Yeah. But I think that reiterates, Lee, what we were talking about right back at the beginning of episode one, which is it's all about the narrative.
And yes, narrative and Hail Marys. That's all it is for me.
I think you've just summed up Necromunda in a sentence. Narrative and Hail Marys.
It's our new tagline.
There's our episode hook.
Okay, that's it. That was early. We got that one pretty early. I mean, we've been talking about merch. That's definitely a bumper sticker, because you know that would people be driving behind you going, "Oh yeah, I completely get that." What's it referred to? Necromunda. So you're doing Escher. What was the reason that you went for Escher? Was there a reason?
Yeah. Do you know what I did a little bit of a look around. So multiple, really. So I collect Death Guard. I've got a kind of a 30k, 40k Death Guard project, kind of in an Istvan kind of three color scheme. So the armies I've had in the past as well, I used to play Tomb Kings and very, very kind of standard color schemes. So I wanted something that I could probably stretch my creative palette on.
Awesome.
I think to some people in the club as well, I've said I'm actually colorblind as well. So I thought, you know, I'm really going to push myself and you know, do some colors rather than just kind of like off white, which has kind of been a theme. So I thought, no, I'm going to pick a gang with a really kind of cool color scheme. I can stretch myself kind of, you know, on the skill front a little bit with painting. But also I think I quite like the lore, you know, the fact that there's a bit of a link there that goes back to, you know, kind of the original, you know, garrison and, you know, with of the Imperial Fists, and, you know, you've got this long standing kind of Escher presence, you know, in the great houses and stuff that I quite like. I really like story arcs that verge on epic, you know, and are big. And for me, Escher just seemed old, and it seemed, you know, ancient, and, you know, in the creative lore behind it. So yeah, I think that's I find that really appealing as well. So.
Awesome. No, I mean, I'd be interested to know what I've got. A couple of colleagues that are colorblind, and so I'm expecting some very garish color pastel color shades.
Yeah.
Which probably look fine to you, and
exactly. And I've always tried to stay away from doing whites and yellows, and now I'm doing lots of it. So I really haven't tried to push myself on the painting technique. God, I hate whites and yellows.
Can I just ask on the Escher front, have you found the time to read the lore from Cinderac Burning or Vaults of Temenos yet?
No, I haven't. No, I've just done the House of Blades book back to front, but nothing else yet. So,
right. So move on to reading about Lady Credo and the Aranthian succession, and it's gonna reignite that kind of like ancient kind of creed vibe for you.
Amazing.
Yes, I mean, the only thing to say is I thought the lore in the Temenos book was phenomenal, and then they didn't convert it into gameplay. But there we go. That's just my little axe to grind.
I haven't finished reading it yet. I'm only about 15 pages into that book. I really must find some time to read through the rest of it.
It's been out for a while, man.
Yeah, I know. I have no excuses, I'm afraid.
Life, the universe, and everything. I know. It always gets in the way.
There's something about the Escher playstyle as well. I'm hoping. I mean, if I can get out of serpent stomachs, the fact they should be relatively speedy, relatively agile. I'm quite naturally a defensive player with tabletop games. You know, no matter what I'm playing, I tend to have quite a defensive bias. So again, in the hope that I'm going to try something different and mix it up, pick something that's a bit more attacky. You know, something that needs a bit of maneuverability and a bit of mobility on the table. So,
I'd kind of describe them as like an Eldar analog. They hit hard and they hit fast, but they can't really sustain prolonged fire, and so you kind of want to. As someone who played Escher in their first campaign, I think you kind of want to team them up, like keep them in little squads of three or four, and draw fighters in, and then launch that lightning counterattack. And they work really well in that regard, I think.
I think it's that counterattack thing where it's almost like that. You want to sucker people in with some kind of lore, and then you have that unit come out of nowhere and go bam. And I think it's just like the Eldar. Not calling them Eldari, they'll always be Eldar to me. That is exactly, I think, their play style. And I've never really played them in new Necromunda. I used to have an Escher gang in old Munda, and I've still got them somewhere. Lead, the actual lead models. But yeah, I like their bikes. I like how quick they are. And again, looking through the lore of the way that you can do chems and bits and pieces like that, it's super interesting to me as from a kind of an outsider looking in, but not enough to make me actually want to play them.
Yeah. And those, whilst I think they're going to be naff on the table, you guys will help keep me true. The Wild Runner models as sculpts are just awesome. So I can see myself picking up some of those girls and getting them painted up and in the cabinet. But I'm not sure they'll make a list, but we'll see.
So if you want some help with them, I think I've got some sort of builds for them that will complement the rest of your gang quite nicely. Like they've got good ballistic skill for what is essentially a Juve. I know they're a prospect, but they're quite cheap with a good ballistic skill. They've got some access to some decent weapons, maybe not the ones that come in the box. And then of course you can give them the, is it Phalanx? The little cat creature.
That's it, yeah.
And you pair those up in certain combinations, with a certain tactic in mind, and I think that it can come together quite nicely.
Yeah, I think it's a shame that the sort of iconic weapon they have, which is the bow, isn't as good as it could have been. So there are other more viable weapon options available for them, but they don't look quite the same.
I'm of two minds about it. I quite like the Rambo fragmentation bow grenade arrow thing and the acid arrows. I just, like you say, I don't think it quite converts into the power of other prospects on the tabletop.
I think that they certainly have options, but they're quite expensive for what they actually are. And there are other ways of doing something very similar, cheaper.
Yeah, agreed, yeah.
It's interesting. I'm looking at the models. I hadn't really paid that much attention. And the character in the middle has almost got a Chaos Cult vibe going on.
Yeah, they are feral, absolutely feral. I love it, absolutely brilliant. They're really clever sculpts, I think.
They've been spending too much time in Fugitive's Drift, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely, no, awesome. So I mean, just trying to think. I mean, so the other thing is to say, so there's obviously you getting into Necromunda, but then there's the Guildersford layer on top of Necromunda, and so as a new player to that. How's that gone? Are you kind of getting au fait, or do you understand how it works, or are you just sort of taking it as it comes because you haven't really got involved in a campaign yet? I think you observed the very
back end of the Ash Wastes thing that we did. So how's that going?
Absolutely fantastic. You know, it's really good. So I think I helped binge listening to GFR before I rocked up. That was that was really cool. Picked up a bit of a flavor at what you're doing. And because I know Guildford, you know, I know kind of the real life inspiration for for the mental map, you know, if you will. That was a really neat touch. That's been absolutely fantastic. What I didn't fully appreciate, you know, and particularly until the last podcast, the villains and heroes of the setting, is actually that it's much more organic than I thought. So originally I assumed that a lot of it was, you know, someone like Dixie, or Gaz or yourself, Lee, in a room and making it all up. I didn't fully appreciate that actually you were adapting and organically growing it, you know, with whilst playing. And I think that was a relatively recent revelation, which is really, really smart. You know, really smart.
We didn't do it on purpose.
I think sometimes it would have been easier to have sat in a room and made up a lot of this stuff.
From anything else that we would have written it all down. Because a lot of this stuff, we're going, oh, we had that amazing game, but we've got any evidence of that? No.
Exactly. And you know, I was taking a look at some of the creative work you guys are doing on the lore, you know, and it's a little bit like absolute credit. You know, I'm not just picking my audience here, but absolute credit, because it is so detailed and there is so much depth, and oh man, the artwork. Huh, just stitches together really, really neatly.
Big shout out to Scott, who's done I said before, he takes the images I don't even know I have in my head and puts them into paper. It's astonishing.
Like Freya, right?
Exactly. Freya and the Enforcers basically are the two big ones. But anything he does is excellent. Check him out. Fantastic.
Yeah, it's really cool. But what I think is really, you know, really smart, and again, I can major on this a little bit from a philosophical perspective, right? But you know, you need something, you need a framework to pin it against, and I think what you've, you know, the 40K universe is massive, right? You know, but the clever thing I think that the Games Workshop have done is made a honeycomb framework. You know, so not everything is prescriptive. There's enough kind of cavities and spaces in there for you to kind of step in creatively and make your own. And what you guys have done, I think, is you found that cavity, you know, within this kind of world of Necromunda, which is kind of, you know, in its own wider vast universe. But you've created your own creative framework and honeycomb that, as a new player, I can come in and go, well, do you know what? You know, if I was going to create a gang and a lore, there is enough little cavities and spaces within the framework you've created for me to have my own little part of that, my own little piece of that, which again, I think, you know, whether it's by design or accident, you know, it's kind of irrelevant. It's genius, I think, with how accessible that then is. A honeycomb, kind of within a honeycomb, right? It's really clever. It's really clever.
That could be the alternative episode title, gents.
Do you know what? I was just thinking exactly the same thing. Thank you for that one, Cal.
Hey, got you covered. I only took like two notes before this podcast, right? And that was it. So, well,
do you know what? If you've got any more gold like that, we'll have it.
I mean, I think honeycombs in a hive all the way down.
Yeah, right.
Brilliant. I mean, credit has to go to Dixie here, because, you know, when he first started, you know, in the club, we're just playing games, and it was just, we just want to play Necromunda, and this was old Munda, you know, way back when we were so much younger, Dixie. I think it just sort of organically evolved, and then it sort of, he started writing stuff down, and then he sort of naturally, did you deliberately take over the arbitration, or you just did it because you liked doing it? I mean, we never really discussed that.
No, I think I just sort of fell into it because there wasn't really anyone else, I guess, willing to do it. And I quite, as I said before, I quite enjoy the story, you know, creating those frameworks and those story arcs. So I think it's just a natural evolution, really.
Yeah, and then it's sort of, you know, what, and the beautiful thing, and again, just I suspect it felt so obvious for you, Dixie, to do that, but to bookend, you know, campaign X to campaign Y, or, you know, sets of games, because it was that whole thing of, you know, play these games and they just pick up and you start from scratch and you just follow whatever is set out in the books, and it feels very sterile. And just, we've always had that very, very organic and living kind of living construct that has now become documented, and I just think it's interesting to hear that completely fresh outside of you coming in, of, you know, because we take a lot of it for granted. A lot of people in the club take it for granted because it's just been there forever.
Well, we can, I suppose that's a nice segue into asking Cal around the what he picked up on from the lore of Guildersford. As you mentioned, we've now we've now actually documented quite a lot. I've been working quite extensively on a book of lore purely around Guildersford. So Cal's had a sneak preview of that in the last couple of days. So what had you picked up on, Cal, before reading that from the tail end of the Ashgate campaign and talking to the other sort of players as you sort of met everyone at the club and all the players that were involved?
Yeah, so I think the concept of Precinct 19, you know, I think that was kind of a key theme, you know, the presence of authority that's kind of always there and sometimes involved, but sometimes not. But the, you know, the eye of Sauron's kind of always there from the enforcers. You know, kind of as well, kind of picked up the key. I'm quite a visual person, right? I like maps and, you know, diagrams and stuff, just cognitively. Kind of had the key areas of the map kind of in my head, I think. So I was, but, you know, Fugitive's Drift and what, you know, the escape docks and stuff. But I think what was quite hard to do originally was to piece those parts of the map together and try and work out where in correlation that they are together. You know, I think it wasn't until really then, you know, obviously picked up the actual rule books, you know, started looking at what the, you know, geography was of Necromunda as a world. And then reading, I think, the, you know, the document that you sent across, Dixie, like I say, it's just awesome. But physically being able to see those constituent parts and then be able to visualize a little bit clearer about where they are in relation to each other. So I think that's been quite difficult to piece because it's so complex and it's so detailed. So that's the thing for me, I think, as I've gone through learning the lore. You know, learning what you guys have created is where each thing happens in relation to each other, I think, you know, rather than just different individual pieces of a wider jigsaw. So does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
It does. I mean, it does indeed, yeah. I mean, there deliberately isn't a map as such of Guildersford, because I have it in my head, but I'm not. Not willing is not the right word, but I don't want to reveal a map because that's too finite, if that makes sense.
Well, absolutely. And you know, it kind of refers back to the point I made around you create enabling the cavities in your creative space for other people to occupy, right? So you know, it enables me to piece my own map together in my own head, my own assumptions. And there'll be a little special place in that for me, for my Escher gang, right? Mentally. And I think that's the clever thing, you know, about not leaving a bit of mystery. I think it's really cool.
I think also the disaster rate within Guildersford would render that map obsolete pretty quickly anyway.
Yes, that's true.
I was reading when I was putting the lore, when I was reading back through the lore stuff I put together that I sent over to Cal recently, I was reading back through some of the actual story arcs that we've had in the previous campaigns, and that I may have gone a bit over the top on like a few of them, but
there's nothing wrong with that.
Everyone enjoyed it, so it's good. It's all fine. Everything's fine. Nothing to see here. Move along.
Nah, keep going. I mean, I'm fully intending in the campaign I'm writing to go as over the top as possible. So it's definitely worth trying.
I just wanted to chime in there quickly, guys, because I think, you know, I think Chris Iddon summed it up recently in their, episode 22 of Sump City Radio, how great it would be to isolate the Dixie gene and sort of... impart that onto other arbitrators. And I think what can be quite imposing for somebody starting out is, well, you know, where do you gain these skills from, you know, these narrative skills? And so I'd quite like to ask you, for the benefit of our listeners, James, what prior experience did you have of any games mastering or DMing or running anything sort of narrative before you've started doing anything with Guildersford?
Absolutely none, basically. So, you know, I think, yeah, pretty much. I think really if you're going to establish a location and start building a lore, you know, as I'm sure listeners have done or are planning to do, it's really just keeping track of everything. So something that, I mean, I wrote down bits and pieces of it as we went along, and that we had our newsletters for the campaigns and stuff like that. And luckily,
Gazette, we should
those.
Bring the Gazette back.
We should give it, yeah. That's, yeah.
The Gazette is how I came to the club, I said to James, like, you know, you've got all this lore and this setting, like, where do I find it? And he said, oh, well, it's all in the old Gazettes. And then that's kind of where the book kind of originated from as an idea with James, because I said to him, well, you know, I've been through these Gazettes, where do I start? And he said, well, actually, I should probably put them in a timeline at some point. And so we started stitching them all together in a chronological order, because by then the House of Chains and House of Blades had come out, and they'd done that wonderful timeline of events and things. And it sort of like got our minds going, well, that would be a great thing for somebody like me coming to the club. And now, of course, Cowers seeing that, you know, that draft product that I think hopefully helps get some of the, you know, the key points across. Does it, Cal?
Well, the timeline section is not in the draft that Cal's seen.
I'm still relaying
that across. Spoilers. into the new bit, but
I've been sold the Duff version.
Oh. Yes, you got the free trial.
Yeah. It's $9.99.
It's 500 creds if you want the full version.
Love it.
It's the interesting thing that I think Cal said initially, but also that feeds into, you know, what Gaz was saying there, that maybe people think, you know, we're going to synthesize the Dixie gene, because maybe people think all this stuff was kind of planned and it was all written down and we've got all this stuff and we're going to do X, Y, Z. And actually it wasn't. We just, oh, that'd be kind of cool if we did that. And then the beautiful thing happens in a particular campaign that makes you go, oh, awesome. We'll make that guy go off and do, or that girl go off and do this. And then we can create a splinter thing, or somebody like, you know, Richard creates a base that then becomes a forward, whatever, you know, all these bits and pieces. And none of that was planned. And I think maybe people think it's a very overwhelming thing to start off. How the hell do I come up with this stuff? And it's like, don't just play it and see what happens.
It's collaborative, isn't it?
It's very much collaborative. I mean, as I said before, I put the framework in place. I come up with an idea for a campaign, and in my head, I have a story arc. In very broad terms, this is what will happen at the beginning. This is what will happen in the middle, and this is what will probably happen at the end if the players haven't derailed it wildly by that point. And then all I do is I take those narrative events that happen during the games and I build those into that into that story arc, and that may then springboard onto future ideas for campaigns, like the Rich building the base, for example. During Genius. The Beyond the Wall campaign, he started his settlement, and then at the end of the settlement he came to me and he said, well, my gang are going to go and do this now, so we are donating this outpost that we've created to Precinct 19. And I'm like, okay, perfect. Now we have an outpost outside of the walls of Guildersford in Fugitive's Drift, which led to the Fugitive's Drift campaign. So it's players are just as much a part of this as I am. So, you know, give it a go. That's all I can suggest.
The Fugitive's Drift name came from the New Blood campaign, didn't it? Because they were essentially fugitives that were pushed outside the wall. Is that right? Or did that name already exist?
Well, the name sort of existed before, but I think it only really became not relevant, but prominent at the end of that campaign.
Gotcha.
Because when you sort of said, you know, how are we going to finish this? We talked about possible endings for it. And then I said, well, if we did this, you know, they could end up in this location and then we could springboard onto something else.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is how you merge one campaign into another.
Absolutely. And I think at that point is the perfect place to segue and leave that there for people to consume and digest and all the rest of it and move on to our next topic. So first of all, Cal, thanks for your insights, and we'd like you to stick around because this section applies to you as much as it does to us, but probably more so for you because you've got loads of new, even more stuff to learn. It's the new rules section, people. How excited are we? Because I'm properly excited, especially for one particular rule, which we'll get to. I know we will. So the new book, as of time of recording this, we are a couple of days prior to release of the book on the 29th of the month, but probably by the time you're listening to this, it will be out. So, you know, it'll be kind of interesting to see how well this ages. It's probably like milk. but yeah, so I mean, I said in the intro, Goonhammer's done a phenomenal article, which I've got in front of me. I've got some notes that I've made, but who wants to jump in first with what rules have changed, their opinions, good or bad? What hot takes have you got? Because I've got a few, shocker. Go for it.
I played a game the other day. A friend of mine just messaged me out of the blue and said, I'm in the area. Do you fancy a quick drop-in game with Necromunda? And I was like, yeah, sure, why not? Always up for that. And then when he arrived, we were talking about the new rules, and we decided to implement a handful of them in the game.
Interesting.
Which was quite an interesting. We weren't 100% sure on some of the nuances, but the main one we tried was the serious injury flesh wound one, which I know
well,
is
you get
the one
to,
you
get
want
the good one first.
To jump. Yeah, exactly. I thought we'll start with the good stuff, you know. And it was slave ogrins versus Vansar on a sump table. And we were basically playing a looters scenario. Wasn't looters, but it was one of those based ones. It was very interesting. I mean, it was noticeable how many more flesh wounds there were, but it wasn't as broken as I was expecting it to be from reading the rules.
Is that because you didn't have lots of high multi-damage weapons?
Well, he rocked up with a 6-man gang of Vansar, including a plasma cannon, a plasma gun, and two plasma pistols. There was a lot of high impact weapons right. there.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Luckily, I mean, I had a lot of Lobo slaves, and they just took repeated plasma guns to the face and just didn't break or run. Shrugged it off. And he had some very unlucky rolls, to be fair. With his wounds and stuff. And then he ran out of ammo on almost everything in the same turn, so I was happy with that because then I could just stomp all over him. game. It was one of those classic games of Necromunda where I was being absolutely battered for about 3 turns, and then it just entirely swung the other way and I stomped him. It was a good game. Really, really enjoyed it.
I mean, I will say straight out the gate that this is my most favorite, and I'm super excited. And when I read it to start off with, I was literally bouncing, going, finally they have done the thing, because everyone knows at the club I harp and moan this is a family friendly show.
You literally were talking to me about it during the Ash Waste campaign, weren't you?
I've done it any number of times. I can't even remember. I played a Gene Sealer Colt before lockdown, and I, you know, mining laser, rolled 3 serious injuries. I'm like, how is this a thing, right? You know, that to me is the single best thing they've done. And if they only did that, I'd be like, fine, I'll take it. But everything else is good. But this one, and especially everything else that stacks with it, like the assist, you know, rules and the skills that you can get for Medicaid, I think that is going to make such a difference to the game. I'm so excited to play.
Agreed.
It.
And that's what I was just about to ask James, is did that come up? Did the assist mechanic come into play in your game?
It did. I didn't myself, because I my ogrins were quite spread out because of the way the deployment worked. But it definitely came up for my opponent. But I think the confusion when they first mentioned it, where nobody was quite sure how that rule was going to be implemented, the fact that it only applies on the second serious injury roll or more, I think is quite well thought out. Because you know, in your situation, Lee, where you roll 3 serious injury dice, or 3 serious injury results, you don't just take 3 flesh wounds. You take 1 serious injury and 2 flesh wounds, which if you can get the assist to then stand up without taking the further flesh wound,
you're fine.
You're okay. And obviously, if you just lay there and bleed out and try and patch yourself up, then you're going to bleed out and take the third flesh wound. Assuming toughness 3. So it definitely opens up some more interesting uses of lesser used mechanics in the game, like the assists and so forth. And I'm really, and that combined with some of the other changes that they made, I'm really looking forward to seeing not just, you know, rinse and repeats of the same tactics and the same builds of gangers and the same skills and the same equipment, because it opens up much more
gang-based
flexibility and much more, much more nuanced gameplay and much more,
Already making me look at Medicaid for our upcoming campaign for one of my champs, because it's now a viable skill.
I mean, there were any number of times I've wanted to take it and gone, there's no point, right? But now there's a point. I mean, it's sort of that thing where you say, really, should gangers be off by themselves because they're just, you know, some grunt that's got a pole with a spiky thing on the end of it or some rubbish auto gun? And really, they want to be running around in packs because they're not good enough. They're not mini Space Marines or even Imperial Guard for that matter. And so the notion that you've got this Juve that's like running off by himself is like, yeah, that probably wouldn't happen. And so I love that thing where it's now you're actually going towards this thing of getting the Medicaid skills, and because you can now buy a secondary skill, 12 XP, sure, it's expensive, but, you know, especially with the buffs, because clearly they've been listening to Dixie and implemented the things that we've been doing for years around other sort of XP gathering mechanisms. I think it's a welcome change.
And I think it also opens up the possibility of more uses of equipment for things like, you know, bio boosters and stuff.
Yeah.
Anything that is going to reduce the number of injury rolls that you actually make in the first place is going to reduce the number of, you know, of things that you can do. Medicaid kits as well.
Yep.
Stuff like that combined with the skills and the assists and everything else. I think there's, it's going to be a welcome change to see gangers actually working to help their comrades rather than just ignoring them bleeding on the floor to continue firing, you know, at the enemy, etc.
And to kind of move this along, because we could probably spend all night talking about just that. I mean, the other thing I think is a welcome change is the penalties to shooting blast markers into not at targets, the -2 to hit into open ground, because, you know, there has been that kind of thing around, oh, you're behind cover. Well, I don't care because I'm going to just, you know, I'm going to ignore that by shooting right in front of the cover and hitting you with the 5-inch blast marker. And, you know, remember me doing that in those test games with Vansar with rad weapons, Dixie. And it's like,
it's
probably not in the spirit of the game. And it always felt a little bit gamey, wacky to kind of pull that off. Although, you know, it's perfectly allowed. So I think the -2, and also just to add into that, I will disagree with Genghis Cohen from Goonhammer that the -1 on the charge, if you can't see, is needed, because he's saying, well, of course, you know, most charges are short range and that's not needed. It's like, well, you've clearly not been listening to Adam and his Hyper Maiden with the Overseer. And of course we can get to Overseer, but, you know, long range charges using stacks of whack. -1 is not going to be massive, but it will make a difference.
Mm. Also, Lee, just touching on something you said there, rad weapons, suddenly much more viable.
Yes.
Yes, I've been looking at those as well. I'm planning on running Vansar in James's next campaign, so I've been looking at Rad, I've been looking at Medicaid. Well, do you know what? I'm sad enough that I went through pretty much most of the house gang
stuff.
Yeah, I did make a big list because I thought it might be useful for people like Cow, actually. So, Cow, I hope you've been taking note. And for your Escher, two things that you're specifically going to want to look at. It's the Chem Alchemy, and that's Blood Rush, and the other one is Jolt. Okay,
so
Jolt, the effect is to the end of the round, the fighter counts any serious injuries they suffer as flesh wounds, so that can keep you on your feet a little bit longer if it was going to put you in a predicament. And Blood Rush, when it's administered to a fighter, they may remove a single flesh wound or immediately recover from being seriously injured. So those two are going to come up for you, my friend.
Does that
so
mean
note those down?
Actually, on that point, recover from being seriously injured, does that mean and not take the flesh wound?
Presumably, yes. If you immediately recover from being seriously injured,
I suppose so.
Well, actually, I don't know. It would depend on the new wording, like James said, because if you're not doing a recovery roll, does that mean you immediately recover and take the flesh wound? Or does it, you know, there might be a little bit of arbitrator's advisement required there.
Discretion, yes. No, fair enough.
That could turn my glass cannons into ceramic, which is very exciting.
Which is better.
Yeah. Marginally better.
There's always going to be a requirement for, you know, updating rules. What are we, 14, 15 books in, doing a compilation of rules from the previous books? There's always going to be gaps and nuances that are not quite you know, you can't cover every single possible combination of wording from that many books.
That's fair. That's fair.
But most players, hopefully, Necromunda players, generally have a good amount of common sense, I think. I might regret saying that.
Well, it depends on how many stacks of whack you want to apply, but yes, it's true.
True, true.
We self-pace.
I mean, I'm quite interested to see some more changes to some of the skills, I think.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that.
I think some of the skills, like hurl and headbutt and stuff, I'm intrigued to see how those can now become more viable. Hurl itself, I think, you know, that's quite fun.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, regardless, I've taken that skill on a few things, Slavogrins in particular, just because it's funny, more than anything else. Brawn, some of the other ones I'm sure will be
headbutt
will be
was
quite interesting.
Kind of interesting. Yeah. The other thing
mentor
I really like,
for me.
Sorry, what?
Mentor's good as well.
Mentor, yeah. Because now, I mean, we've been running our own house based XP system for as long as I've been at the club. And you guys have obviously been running way before that. But mentor was a good skill before, but now it's a good skill for everybody else.
Yeah.
And hopefully that in combination with, say, the change to secondary skills now being choosable on 12 yeah. XP, yeah. that's going to mean we're going to see more variety in builds. So
there's some very interesting combinations of secondary skills that were being talked yes. about on Sump City today on Facebook. So.
Yes. I particularly
incidentally, I forgot to mention, guys, I was having a chat with Steve from Sump City earlier on, and he did ask me to say hello to everybody for him. So,
hello,
hi.
Excellent.
Yeah. Hi, Steve.
I particularly like the little house, the rule they brought in for Psyker, so the continuous action is now just a free, you get to do it. Okay, but obviously, you can't enact another psychic power on top of it. Fine.
Yeah, I think that's a house rule that most clubs have been running for quite a long time. So it's nice to see that, you know, in writing finally.
Yeah, I thought that was good. Considering that I'm toying with the idea of running Dalak in the next, simply because I want to go Psyker Heavy, because I've never done Psyker Heavy before.
Well, that's because the last Psyker you used, you physically crushed immediately because you died in turn one of the first game you played.
I did. And I did say this game we're playing, I'm playing Permadeath Necromunda. It's happening, people.
True, that is true.
We're playing I'm playing permanent. So for people that maybe missed in the last episode or not, I'm going to admittedly 3D print my gang this time. And Dixie is allowed to get his gavel out. And every time I go out of action, he can kill the model.
I'm going to crush it with the bell.
You're going to crush it with the bell.
Crush it with the
arbitration. We don't advise that you try this in your own campaigns.
Well, I don't know. Hobby hardcore, right?
We'll see. We'll get some video and photographic evidence for people. Yeah. I'm sure it'll be fine.
I also like the idea of the convalescence thing in the loss of injuries table. I think that and the spice and the extra thing they brought back, like the scars and the bits and pieces like that. I think that's a really nice change.
I'm a big fan of those.
The narrative, yeah.
Well, narratively, that was always a thing in the old Necromunda, wasn't it? Old battle scars and stuff like that. You know, and how it affected people. Capturing, I think, is.
Yeah.
An interesting change. I really need to see how that works in practice in terms of how often it triggers.
Well, considering that's going to play heavily into the campaign I'm writing, yes.
But, I don't know if at the moment, for example, whether it... Because currently it's limited to one fighter, isn't it? Like, if you capture somebody, you capture one person.
At the moment. Yes.
So there is now, in theory, if you were very, very... If it's now a capture being a specific lasting injury result,
yeah,
you could be very unlucky and have multiple people captured.
Well, it's saying, in theory, one in every 18 fighters can expect taken out of action can be expect to be captured.
Yeah, which is obviously a probability based on the range within the table. But we all know that table ranges don't necessarily equate to exact statistics.
Yeah, we saw a lot of D6s.
I think that would be interesting. I'd be intrigued as well to see how that combines with some of the equipment and skills that increase the chance of capturing fighters, like Magnacles or Restrain. Web is covered in the Google
article. They talk about it in the article, but yeah, I mean, can you imagine? Can you stack Web with Manacles?
I think
you could Magnacle somebody and then
web them,
restrain them with a coup de grace, and you're getting plus 4 or 5 to the capture result.
nice.
As it is now, I mean, that's what I want to see about the new rules. Obviously, I play a lot of Precinct 19 and they have a lot of Magna Calls and stuff. So I think that could be quite interesting. And again, that feeds into the narrative, because if you're seeing more captures and both gangs are seeing captures, then you're going to see more exchanges and stuff like that happening. Which I suppose anything that gets players interacting more like that is good.
I suppose the other thing it does, though, is potentially force you, Dixie, to inject more recovery type games into campaigns, because people might not want to do exchanges but actually go fight for their fighter, potentially. And so how does that actually affect the construction of the campaign missions that you've got in mind?
Well, we've always run it as a house rule that rescue missions are entirely separate from the campaign. So if your fighter is captured and you want to run a rescue, that's fine, do that.
I never bother. But yes.
At any point. But that's the thing. Most people don't bother. They just come up with an agreement, an exchange for money or equipment, or they just kill them and throw them in the sump, you know? We have a lot of rivalries and enmities resulting from people just being shot because they can't afford the exchange rate or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, one thing I'm pleased about with this is that it increases the value of items such as web solvent, skin blades, which are things that I've never even thought about taking on in the campaign.
I've never seen the point.
Right, because the you know, rarely comes up. And the other thing is, and I've discussed this with James before, is that I think the sentry and sneak attack rules, thematically and narratively, are really interesting to me, like the sabotage missions, the rescue missions, public execution. They sound like great scenarios to play, really fun, until you get to the fact that with the existing rules, that there's no player agency on the behalf of the defender until the alarm's completely raised, right?
And I have deliberately removed all of those missions from the last three or four campaigns, because every single time any player at the club has played them, they have not enjoyed it. The defender has not enjoyed it.
Yeah,
basically.
And what they were saying...
The change to that in the new rules, I think, again, I want to see the full set of rules before I give too much of an opinion, but it definitely is a step in the right direction.
Yes, I was just about to say, I'm excited to see, from what they mentioned in the Goonhammer article, as to what changes they've made there for the sentry rules and the sneak attack rules. So hopefully it's a lot more viable.
The other one I'm hoping that they have done something with is the reinforcement rules and the way that those interact with certain scenarios. Because that is also another, you know, the random gang size and reinforcements and things can lead to some very, very weird dynamics.
Yeah.
We had that one in the Ashgate campaign, didn't we? I think it was two people on the table to start for the defender and like eight for the attacker. And both of the defenders were taken out of action immediately on the first turn because there was nothing they could do because there's only two of them.
Yeah, and that's it, game over.
Well, I think part of the mechanic there that we don't really employ, or I haven't seen us employ at the club, is the rolling and the choosing on behalf of a player as to what scenario to pick. And I understand why we've done that. And I think it generally makes it easier to run on the night, you know, make sure we've got enough printouts of all the scenarios that we're playing, etc. Everyone's playing the same scenario. But actually, like that introduces a degree of tactics or balancing. If you're the underdog and you can choose the battlefield and the mission to play to your strengths, even if you're against a tougher opponent.
I mean, maybe with the new cards or the derivation, we could potentially have a selection or a limited selection from, you know, so it's not that it's going to be one, but it could be one of a couple that, you know, allows people to select, oh, we'll play this one rather than this one. You know, that could be an option.
Hmm. Yeah, there's definitely lots of options. I think, again, changes of rules with, 140-odd existing scenarios or whatever we're up to now. It may need some arbitration input just to make sure that those are still as balanced or unbalanced as they were previously.
Yeah.
But Necromunda's not a balanced place, so, you know.
No, and I don't think we want balance, but I think we want equivalency.
I want parity. I'm not even too worried about balance. I just want the players to enjoy the game.
Yeah, no one wants
and if
to
you
be
bring
stopped.
To, you know, you've come all the way to the club to play games for 3 or 4 hours and your two fighters are deployed and taken out of action within 5 minutes, then it's not fun for anyone.
Hmm. So cow. So we've just spoken for ages on that stuff, and probably a lot of it is like, oh, what's going on? So from a new player coming in, and you know, obviously starting to learn the rules, like you were saying, the initial rule set is fairly easy to get into. What of the new rules, the changes, do you feel are a big change or something that you kind of don't really can't get behind? Anything? Any comments?
Yeah. I feel like a puppy wagging its tail because I'm feeding off the excitement of my owners and not really knowing why I'm so happy. No, it's a really good point. So I'm a relatively kind of casual hobbyist, right? And by that, I mean, yeah, you know, like a lot of us, you know, life, right? It is kind of takes up the majority of time, and you know, I end up then squeezing. So I think the just going to bring the level of IQ of the conversation down a little bit away from some of the detail. But when I got into when I got back into 40K, I kind of picked up 8th edition again. I swear it felt as though by the time I had, you know, picked up 8th edition, picked up kind of, you know, the latest rule set, you know, scoped an army, painted the army, before I even had a chance to get it on the table, 9th was out, right? And then I was adapting again, and then I did the same with Sigma. I picked Sigma up, and then I swear by the time I brought kind of the Stormcast and Khorne, you know, Khorne box set, I forget what it was called for Sigma. You know, there's another rule set. You know, they brought edition 3 out, I think they're on now. You know, so I think, and I can't believe it. It's happened. It feels like it's happened again, right? So I brought the core. I didn't get Ash Wastes. I decided, you know what, I'm just going to pick up the core rule set, pick up a gang book, and then start a gang and kind of keep my, you know, entry level relatively low and just kind of get into it and let it organically grow rather than going for a big bang, you know, if nothing else, but for the wallet. And then there's another book out and you think, oh man, you know, so I think the suggestions around Goonhammer are great. You know, I've got familiar with the website, you know, absolutely fantastic what the guys are doing on there. So I think what I'm going to do actually as a first port of call is to actually just jump into Goonhammer. You know, learn the book that I've got and just jump in and let dare I say it's a little bit lazy, right? But let you guys and let Goonhammer kind of help steer the areas of the rule changes that have happened and allow me to focus into that. And I think, you know, time permitting, I'd love to go through and do it. I just don't have the time. And I think for those that are listening, kind of that are on the newer end, you know, of getting into the hobby, just don't let Games Workshop's obsession with editions and books put you off. You know, enjoy the setting. Enjoy the models and let everything else just kind of flow. You know, don't try and chase the list. And so yeah, I've avoided. I think if we ran the clock back a couple of years, I would have got really frustrated by the fact I've just bought a book. I've just got into it. And then it's all changed again. And I've got outlay. I know it's 20, 30 quid. Well,
I think in your situation, it's not actually as bad as you make it, because the book that you've bought isn't really being, it's a specific thing. And the rules that you get are a layer on top of the core rule book. So if you'd have gone and bought the core rule book, yeah, okay, fair enough. Right. But I think, and I also think, you know, something that you said there about not worrying about it, because you haven't necessarily played a great number of games, especially in a campaign setting, I think what my feeling, and again, Dixie, Gaz, you know, disagree with me, is you will probably, just through playing in Osmosis, pick up an awful lot of these changes. And because, I mean, I'm slightly envious of you, actually, because, you know, it, like you say, with different editions of 40K or different editions of you almost have to unlearn what you've learned so that you can then start to play again. And I mean, I remember when 7th edition 40K came out and we were playing rules and we were doing it completely wrong because we were playing 6th and we hadn't, oh yeah, we know what we're doing. Yeah. Fine. We'll carry on. And it's like, hang on a second, but this is wrong. And so I imagine, you know, I will be guilty and I'll apologize in advance of going, oh, this is the rule and I know it. And people go, no, hang on, that's changed because this is the new rule set and I've got to kind of internalize and discard, you know, wish I could pull a Johnny mnemonic, there's that dates me that, and I could delete long-term memory because I don't want it anymore.
I think probably an important thing just to take a sort of side step on that. There's absolutely nothing wrong with using the rules as is and continuing to use the rules as is if both players are happy doing that, even in a campaign setting.
That's fair enough.
You know, if preach. If, but if you've got, let's say, you know, we had 14 players in the last campaign, you know, 7 games per night, 2 players per table. If half of those people are playing with the new rule book and half of those people are playing with the old rule book, it doesn't really matter outside of things like serious injuries.
I was going to say that would be the
one. Do you know what I mean? So like that is, and that's you can get that table is going to be easy to see. It's not a major problem.
Yeah.
Because if you need to roll for an injury, you can just call over the arbitrator and they'll tell you what the injury is. But the core mechanics are basically the same.
Yeah.
There's a few tweaks, there's a few improvements, there's a few changes to the way certain things interact. But if two players are both playing on the same rule set, even if that rule set is, you know, the 2018 version or the 2023 version,
mm-hmm.
that's fine. It doesn't make a huge difference. What this is gonna annoy a lot of people probably, and then it can run the community. But what I may even end up doing is just grabbing a marker pen and, you know, on some of my older books and just writing the new rules in.
Ooh.
Because
that's a bit too far.
Yeah. Well, I did it with my old Guard Codex when they changed, you know, as Callum said, they changed the rules multiple times, their point values and stuff like that. I just took a pen and just wrote over the top. I mean, because what are you going to do with the codex eventually? Like, what are you going to do with the old Necromunda rule book?
Enshrine it.
You going to sell it? Or are you gonna,
no, it goes into my library. You
know, I'm going to worship it.
It goes
in my
on the shelf. And
rule books.
Yeah, it goes on the shelf and you use it. And, you know, if it's your book, you paid for it, it's paper, you just write in it the updates if you need to.
You're one of those disgusting people that crack the spine on software, on paper.
No, like, no.
Monster.
No. I like the, as long as the outside looks good.
I quit this podcast. I can't bear to be in the same virtual room as this man anymore.
Oh, dear. I think you're right there, Lee. I'm in a really kind of, you know, blessed position. You know, if I get over the fact I've got to buy another book, you know, and add another coffee book to the collection, you know, albeit a great one with great lore and, you know, great creative art and stuff, I'm not really going to know much difference, right? You know, I'm jumping into it, and you know,
I think the thing that annoys me more than anything else is I've got to clear out a second section of my Kallax unit to fit start a new shelf. Like,
yeah.
I've run out of room. I can't fit any more rule books in there.
Part of the when I did my study revamp, I made an extra big shelf. Going, I know there are going to be more books. Here's the space.
I hope you reinforce that shelf.
I did. I was sad enough to actually go on an engineering website and actually work out how many brackets I needed for the span. I was, I did. I kind of.
The only thing I give Games Workshop a lot of credit actually in the way that they run their, you know, creative enterprise. But whilst in a lot of other mechanisms they've got, you know, other game systems, there is a bit of, I certainly feel a bit of book fatigue. And, you know, Lee said earlier, there is a degree of kind of meeting the tournament frenzy, right, in you know, quarterly, monthly updates, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, what is nice is that there is a game system like Necromunda that they're still investing in. And, you know, they are continuing to evolve and put time and resource in. And actually think things do evolve. You know, you know, it's not necessarily just kind of meta that changes it, right? But there are some things that, you know, do need to evolve over time.
It's interesting that you talk about book fatigue, because there's theoretical mental book fatigue, and then there's actually physical book fatigue, where you have to walk into the club with 20 actual books that weigh God knows how many kilos.
Exactly.
I mean, I think one, just going back to what we were talking about, the changes in the rules, I think one of the things we had already done, which needed changing and addressing, was the trading post side of things.
Oh, yes.
So we've been using our own trading post in Guildsford for a long time now, which is a combined, you know, the trading post is one entity. You go to the trading post and then you roll and you get a rarity value and an illegal value, and all the illegal items are in one section of the trading post and all of the rare items and common items are in another section. So, you know, that was what we were doing anyway, and it's interesting to see that is how it's now being worked officially in the book, because to me it made absolutely no sense that you had to go with a separate action to the black market to buy low sticks, for example, because they're a common item. Like, they're going to be available on every single possible corner in Necromunda that you don't have to go specifically to an illegal market to buy them.
We can get into the silliness of having to go to the trading post to go and buy a house pet. I never understood that.
Well, that's the old.
Originally, like when they very first came out, it's like I like a sump croc. I'm a Goliath. I can't go to my house then because I have to go to the special dude that only sells Goliath stuff to Goliath people at the trading post. What? Yeah.
Although it's a very good excuse to buy the model from Forge World for the pet exotic pet trader, which is an awesome model.
True, but that is that still going? Has that been discontinued? I can't actually. Is that?
I think it's still going.
I've got one here.
I haven't built or painted it yet, but I'm very much looking forward to it.
The model's very recent. It's a beautiful model. Come in a pack with, I think, the relic seller and the woman.
The gun handler
or whatever. Yeah, that's
sorry.
It, yeah.
Yes. Yes, I know the one you mean. Yes. Oh, there it is. Yeah.
Great variety in those as well.
Yeah.
So I think the combined, is it 40 odd pages or something of that? So I'm intrigued to see what's in there, and also whether there's anything new in there.
Of the trading post, their trading post.
The official trading post. Because obviously we've got our own house stuff that we've added in, like life jackets for the sump and everything. Yeah. And actually, we should talk about the sump in a second as well.
Oh, yes, the Apocrypha. Yeah.
That was yesterday that came out, wasn't it, I think?
Again,
yes.
How many years ago?
Well, again, we had a version of it, which I then updated when the vehicle and the ash waste rules came out.
It was pre-2019, because you already had the rules when I came to the club.
Yeah, the version that came out in the Apocrypha yesterday is very interesting how similar that is to the rules that we had already implemented, which, it's great. It clearly shows that I'm on the same wavelength. That's my take on it. But
yes.
But I'm looking forward to doing some more.
Other opinions are also valid.
Of course. I think our rules are slightly more
brutal,
because anyone, we have stuff like anyone who's in the water can also attract the attention of creatures in the water, like sump crocs, etc. But we got some house items like buckets of bait and stuff like that, fishing loads that you can chuck in.
I love that idea.
So if you use a harpoon or a knockback weapon to chuck somebody into the water, then chuck a bucket of bait in them and wait for the sump crocs to appear.
or an Esha like that. Queen, it seems.
Or an Esha Queen, for sure. I'm looking forward to things like that, seeing how like the trading post, and I think a lot of, because of the book fatigue to a degree, that there's stuff for the trading post split over five or six different books now.
Oh yeah, that too.
So I'm also hoping to see the Wasteland Workshop stuff in there for the vehicle upgrades, because
I don't think that's in there. I think that that's still part of Book of the Outlands from what I've been reading around on Discord. They've kind of kept the profiles and the upgrades as specific to that book. So you'd still need that. In recent memory, there hasn't been a better time to come to Necromunda than now and pick up this core rule book, because it amalgamates lots of stuff like the Book of Peril, things from the Book of Judgment, not necessarily the campaigns. Maybe we'll see those revisited like they've done Dominion here, but all of the items, etc., have all been rolled into this one book, like you say, and the vehicle rules are in there. So it's a nice update, almost like a soft reset, for this edition, and maybe it'll be a couple of years before we get a full second edition or fourth edition. Is it now officially?
It's 5 years since the first core ones came out in 2018, wasn't it? I think.
Yeah, and I think that's third edition officially of Necromunda, isn't it? So this would be fourth edition
is sort of third and a half, isn't
3.5,
it?
3.5, really?
Yeah, it's
what
not a
second
full,
edition.
Full change.
Second edition was when they did the Fanatic era stuff, I believe. Necromunda Underhive was second edition.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that. Sorry,
I'm sold on the new book. I've got such a jelly spine, honestly. absolutely sold. I tell you what, I
think the problem you might have is finding one in the near future.
Yeah, they are.
Let's not go down that rabbit hole.
No. But to move into talk about camp, I mean, I wanted to just say, I mean, the fact that we've had the combined trading post in, you know, Guildersford has been a godsend, because like I think you said, Gaz, having different books with things in, I could never remember what was in what. And just so I kind of gave up on the old trading post and have been using it almost exclusively ours or what's in Yak Tribe, because I just could never remember what's in what. And I think that's just from an admin perspective, very nice, very good. But I think to carry on, I think also one of the things I'm super, super excited about is the campaign changes, you know, and all the things that they've done around the different kinds of campaigns, not just Dominion. But I loved the idea of, where's it gone? The things around, the Iron Man campaign, where you get loads of money up front and then you can't get anything else afterwards, or the Last Gang Standing. I think those are really, and I'm sure there are clubs out there that have been doing kind of their own version of that. I don't think, and we've sort of done, and we're going to talk about something in the next segment about our custom scenario. But I love the idea that they're kind of putting these things out there to say it isn't just Dominion, it isn't just Ash Waste. Interesting.
There's so many more possibilities out there.
Yeah.
I think the last comment for me, sorry, just before we move on to the next section, is the other welcome change is around the gang tactics.
Yes.
They've put in, three different standard options that you can do it. So the preset, custom, and the limited methods, all of which, you know, perfectly fine as well. So definitely some improvements there in terms of limiting the numbers of cards that people have, or varying the cards between players, etc. I think we'll probably continue to use our method,
but I did like the idea of the use it and then burn it. Notion of a tactics card. I thought that was...
Yeah, we've talked about that a few times, haven't we?
Yeah, we have.
I still
like that idea.
Deliberating that one.
The thing is, there's so many now that it's like, well, you know, what about people then that only buy like one pack? So then they're going to get through them a lot quicker. So therefore they might get some of the previous ones come up. Whereas those people that own like all the packs might have like, you know, it take you campaigns and campaigns to work your way through them all.
Well, so because I drew all of the Ash Gate campaign tactics cards from my single deck of all of them, because I've got every single card.
Yeah.
And we had no repeats of cards over 14 players over an 8-week campaign,
which is amazing.
Yeah, it was great for variety. Okay.
We probably could again spend the entire podcast just talking about the rules, and again, as I said, the book has not officially dropped for us, so there may be things that we've got wrong, and it will be really interesting to hear people's comments about what they think of our opinions, and do you disagree with us, because you know this is the whole beautiful thing. It's a narrative, beautiful environment, as Cal pointed out at the top of the show, and what's great to me is not so necessarily so great to you. So we really want to hear from the community on this. I think it's going to have a pretty big impact, especially some of the, you know, things like the Medicaid and the serious injury changes are going to have a huge impact, and we really want to know what you think. So we're going to move on. And the next topic we're going to talk about, well, again, segueing from the campaign section into the next campaign that Dixie's going to be running, which, again, Cal, is right up your alley, because we're doing a Back to Basics campaign. So, Dixie, tell us all about it.
Right. So, two things for this. One, this is a campaign that we have run before. We've talked about it several times in previous episodes. So it was actually one, it was interrupted partway through by the
plague,
the COVID-19 pandemic. So we only got kind of just over halfway through the campaign. I think we were four games in before lockdown hit, basically. And obviously we couldn't go to the club for a year plus. So it's nice to be able to revisit it and take that on. The other thing we are doing, and I'll just caveat this with if real life timing permits me, we should be releasing a campaign pack for the listeners so that you can run Back to Basics campaigns yourselves if you so wish to. It doesn't have any specific rules in there around, you know, actual Necromunda rules, but it is a campaign guide primarily for the arbitrator as to this is what the campaign is, here are the way that we are going to run it, here are some optional rules you can put in there, and some sort of tips and hints and so on for the arbitrator, about how to actually run the campaign and how to interact with the players and so on and so forth. So,
the Dixie gene.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think it's safe to say, I mean, I've mentioned I'm in the middle of writing a campaign and Ross has got a load of things. And I think we're all kind of taking a cue from Dixie on that to say, well, we should probably think about making that stuff available in the same vein, branded and all the rest of it, so that we, kind of have that mentality going forward for longevity, et cetera, et cetera. So watch this space on that stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing. The feedback generally from you guys, the listeners, is that you love what we're doing with the campaign. So we're more than happy to share that across to you guys.
Absolutely.
So that's what we're looking at.
Yep.
I love the idea of running this campaign, by the way. Absolutely love it. Having joined you for the Ash Race campaign and, seeing everyone grapple with vehicle rules and there's me kind of like working out which way the dice go. The fact that you said this was coming up just took all the pressure off, having to pick up a multitude of other rules. I love the fact you're doing it. I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, can I ask you a question, Cal? Because I don't actually know how much know about Back to Basics. And it was the first games I ever played of Necromunda, this edition, at the club, straight into the campaign. Because I think I went down the week before it started, maybe 2 weeks before, and met James and got introduced.
Very good timing.
Oh, it was perfect, really. It was serendipitous. But I'm just interested from where you are now, like, what does the name Back to Basics mean for you? If you were envisioning a basic campaign, what are your expectations of that?
That's a great question. Yeah. Do you know what? I think I am expecting Zone Mortalis or something similar, a relatively limited but basic gang structures. No vehicles, limited vehicles potentially, or no vehicles. And the idea that effectively everyone's kind of picking up or playing the campaign solely based on not a stripped down version of the complete rule set, but, a kind of the core mechanic, the very core. So I'm expecting kind of, a 1,000 creds tops to get a gang, some limitations, and then to run through run through the campaign that way. So that's my, and it's a guess. That's my guess.
Because you haven't seen any of the previous Back to Basics campaign stuff or anything that James drafted so far, right?
Nothing. I've seen absolutely nothing. No.
Well, so James, does exactly what it says on the tin then, doesn't it?
Okay, so I'm going to caveat this by saying that I have a 95% completed PDF with all of this stuff in it before we saw any of the new campaign stuff from the new rulebook that's coming out. So the Back to Basics campaign is very similar in principle to the classic campaign that Games Workshop have implemented. Although I would say it is even more stripped down and basic, because it's purely intended as a allow the players to focus on learning the core rules of Necromunda without worrying about any of the other stuff that goes alongside it and causes confusion, because that can come later when they play the next campaign.
That'll be mine.
Yeah. So that would just confuse them even more, Lee. But
yep.
There we go. So let's talk first around the narrative aspect of it. So the Great Fire, as you all have picked up from previous episodes, obviously, raised half of Guildersford to the ground. And the Back to Basics campaign was set in a new area that had been rebuilt and reopened, and then was bringing new gangs and new settlers and new citizens back into that zone. And it was designated as a restricted weapon zone. So there are two mysterious unknown benefactors who are sort of linchpins of the narrative of the campaign. And those two benefactors have basically subsidized the rebuilding of that zone. And to protect their investment, they've asked Precinct 19 very nicely to not allow any kind of heavy weaponry or unusual weaponry into that area. So that's the kind of hook. Basically, they're two very strange, mysterious benefactors. Nobody knows who they are. And they are organising all of this.
They want to protect their investment, right? Is that's the kind of vibe? Like they want to.
Yeah, you've just spent billions of credits having an area of an entire settlement rebuilt. You don't want to have a gang suddenly just start opening fire with heavy bolters and multi melters and stuff, do you?
Yeah, exactly.
Because then you just have to rebuild it again almost straight away. So that's the sort of the narrative hook, and there's a bit more information about how that works within the pack that we'll put out, basically. So the intention of the campaign itself is just to split, is to slim everything right down to the absolute minimum. So it's the six standard house games only, to make things nice and easy. There's no tactics cards, there's no house favors, there's no bad zone events, there's no vehicles, alliances, you know, any of that extra stuff in any of the other, you know, 14 or so books. It's not used in the standard campaign. It allows people then, you've got your six house gangs, and it allows people to use elements of those gangs and the house, you know, peculiarities like chems or gene smithing and so on, and focus on getting to know the core mechanics of the game, as well as the, you know, the basic mechanics of how their actual house, their chosen house, works. So the way it works is it will be a six cycle campaign. Territories and income is very simplified. Scenario rewards are very simplified. Weapons and gang lists are very simplified. And the intention is to have two teams, one for each benefactor. And the teams are, the benefactors are fighting between themselves for more control of the zone once it's opened. So you end up in a, you know, you end up in this situation where you've got the two teams, and it makes matching players during the campaign very easy, because all you've got to do is find somebody from the opposing team. Hopefully, if you have enough players, you can cycle through six games without playing the same person each time. But you know, there's some guidance in there that if you've got fewer players than that, you can rotate people around and so forth. Territories for the purposes of this campaign are generic. So the actual nature of those territories has no impact at all. So whether it's, you know, a hab block or a trading post or whatever it might be, they just, every territory generates a generic amount of money after each game. Every week, a territory is selected, and whichever of the benefactors team wins the most games that week takes control of the other territory. So, you know, you'll see territories changing hands, but the exact nature of those territories is completely irrelevant to the campaign, because all it affects is 50 credits goes to one team or the other team, depending who controls that territory that week.
I love that idea.
So it removes that kind of the confusing aspect sometimes of, you know, you can play an Ash Waste game and, you know, have like half your fighters die for various reasons because of dangerous terrain or whatever else, and you come away with like D6 credits,
yeah,
or something stupid at the end of it. So it, you know, you don't need to worry about any of that stuff, because territories as a whole just generate a fixed amount of income per territory, per team. And then as per the standard rules, the income from that team's territories is just equally split between the players each week. Okay, so 50 credits per territory. If you've got 10 territories, that's 500 credits. You've got five players, they get 100 credits each. Nice and simple.
Straight
it also makes arbitration very easy. So this is also a very good campaign for somebody who's starting out arbitrating, to get their head around how some of these mechanics work before they take on a slightly more complicated campaign like Dominion, for example. There's some interesting optional stuff. I'll come back to that in a second. The other thing that is universally changed is scenario rewards. So again, a lot of scenarios are unbalanced, either in the mechanics of the deployment of the players, as in, you know, somebody gets custom 10 and somebody else gets random D3 plus one, you know, so it's unbalanced in that sense.
Yep.
Or the rewards for the scenario are unbalanced and make little sense. So what this does is...
Isn't that just all the scenarios?
Well, not all of them. There are a few, but, you know, there's a lot of scenarios that are not balanced. And that's why nobody plays them, you see. So this allows you to replace any scenario, basically, that you want to, with a generic reward. So in terms of credits, the winning gang gets 50 credits, the losing gang gets 25 credits, and if it's a draw, you both get 25 credits. Nice and easy.
Yep.
Experience, the winning gang leader gets an XP. Every fighter who takes part in the battle gets an XP. Nice and simple. Reputation, winning gang adds 2 rep, losing gang adds 1 rep. If you bottle out, you lose 1 rep. So worst case scenario, net 0 gain.
It makes a lot of sense. It's very simple, very easy. I think, you know, your perfect my first arbitration campaign.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the intention. I've put some optional rules in. For example, for the mysterious benefactors, what we had in the first version of this campaign, we had two actual people who were not participants in the campaign. And one of whom wasn't even a member of the club, actually role played as the benefactors. Their identities should be a secret from everybody except the arbitrator, and including from each other. So if you're gonna go down that role play, and that ties into the next optional extras, the identities of those benefactors should remain secret, and even after the campaign, I would say as well, because you might want to revisit and use this narrative function in other campaigns later on. So tying into that, if you do have actual people participating as the benefactors, then you can do stuff like let the benefactors decide how that income from the territories is split up each week. So you've got that 500 credits. They might want to give it all to one gang, or they might want to split it or skew it and things like that.
I remember that from the last time we did this, and you had a lot of people because it was sort of, you had to kind of plead your case, and I was role playing it as, I think, was that the campaign I was playing Corpse Grinders? And I was like, yes, I'm not role playing. I'm not pandering to you. I'm not doing anything. And you can get this kind of sycophantic, well, please give me the money. He's like, no.
Exactly. So that's the third optional thing, is that rather than just splitting the money equally between all the players, if you do have your actual people and you're allowing the benefactors to split the money, is get the players to write to the benefactors in character to say, you need to give me X amount of credits because so-and-so died last game, or we need to buy a weapon, or we need to do this, or we need to do that. So it's a really good narrative hook to get the players involved in writing that story. It's also really useful for the arbitrator if they do it on that basis, is because you can use those pleas from the players to track stuff like your victories and your casualties and your gang ratings and things as part of that petition process.
Yes.
So there's a few options there. Again, this is all detailed in the campaign pack that we'll put out, so don't worry about trying to remember it or keep listening on repeat to this to understand what's going on. It is hopefully laid out very, very easily and simply for people to read. The final part of it then is in relation to the gangs themselves. So it's a restricted weapon zone, so there is a restricted weapons list in place. So fighters can only... You buy from your house books, so you know, House of Blades or Chains or whichever one is your flavour. But weapons in particular are restricted to a list within this campaign pack. And in essence, for everybody except the gang leader, that is just a list of the common items from the trading post. So las guns, auto guns, shotguns, las pistols, auto pistols, stun guns, axes, pointy sticks, flails, that kind of stuff. Again, that is very, very deliberate. Those weapons are generic. They're very easily available. They're the type of weapons that you would expect to see in Necromunda.
They're all listed as well, aren't they?
They're all listed. The rules for them, you will need to refer to your house book, but the list of what those weapons are is in the document. You pay the price shown either in your house book or the trading post, whichever is cheaper. And it puts everyone on an even playing field in terms of the actual weaponry that they have access to. The only difference is for the leader of the gang specifically, they have both a ranged and a combat weapon from their house list that is themed to their house. So for example, the Lack have access to a grav gun and a shock stave, Goliath have access to the rivet cannon or spudjacker. So there is some house flavor in there just to start getting people to think about how their particular house works with particular types of weapons. There are optionals in, you know, there's optional rules in there. If you want to expand that out, you could just use just the weapons and equipment listed in the house book entry, for example, and you ignore the trading post entirely. But the intention for this is that you have everyone except the gang leader has just a generic weapon. The gang leader has, you know, a house weapon, and then war gear, armor, grenades, pets, brutes, hangers-on, etc. are unaffected. So any war gear items you can buy from the trading post as standard, because then you get, you know, you're going to have some extra credits to spend because you're not buying fancy plasma cannons all the time. So you can start experimenting with some of the more interesting war gear options and grenades and stuff like that.
So James, you, you've limited this to the six houses, haven't you, for this campaign, just to help keep things more condensed and simplified. The one thing that came up when we were discussing it, because I'm thinking of taking my Van Sark gang and digging them up out of the dusty crate that they're sat in at the moment, was that they're kind of modelled with Laz versions of a lot of these basic weapons. And I just kind of wanted to point out that, like, that's probably something that other players might come across as well. So I sort of approached you, didn't I, and said, well, could I run, say, like the laser as a shotgun, because that's essentially what it is. It's just got plentiful instead of, but it doesn't have access to the same ammo profiles as the, you know, the solid shot analog or etc.
Yeah. I mean, I think obviously we don't need to see players necessarily building gangs specifically for this campaign with those weapons. So things like the suppression laser. There's no reason to not use it as a shotgun, or even a las gun, you know, las carbines or whatever else. Whatever equivalent weapon the ganger is holding, just find the nearest equivalent from that list. And as long as you tell your opponent what it is, and they do the same, and then it shouldn't be an issue.
Yep, sounds great. I mean, I enjoyed it the first time round, although we didn't get to finish it. And obviously playing a completely different gang again, because I'm not doing Corpse Grinder Cult. We might talk about those in a minute. So, Callum, what do you think?
Do you know what? I'd love to ask you guys a question, right? For as veteran, veteran gangers, what's it like running a basic campaign from your perspective and stripping it back? You know, does it feel like you're doing a community service for the new folks that are in the club or relatively new to it, or do you still get the same kick out of it as you do from, you know, encompassing all the rules? What's it like from your perspective in terms of actually playing it and enjoyment?
I've got strong opinions on it.
Go on, Gaz.
Well, it was my first foray back into any kind of wargaming for many, many years. And the thing that drew me back to Necromunda specifically was partly like the real world thing of not having enough time to paint a whole army and you know, cart them somewhere for an hour to get wiped out on turn two, and finding that really unfun. So I kind of went for a narrative game, a skirmish game. And then I thought, well, you know, I really enjoyed Necromunda when I was younger, but I didn't really get into it all that much because it was hard to find campaigns. And then the other thing that attracted me to it was the fact that, you know, it's just a load of desperate people in the 41st millennium with pointy sticks and rusty pipes and, you know, the odd gun that misfires. And they're trying to, you know, scrape by for survival. And I think the newer version of Necromunda allows you to kind of go a bit more sort of paramilitary gang by the time you're a few games in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas this, back to basics, when I played it in 2019 or 2018, whenever it was like a real fantastic way to kind of get that, live that kind of narrative aspect of what I felt Necromunda was and that part of it that is unique for the 41st millennium, you know, Grimdark universe. I don't think there's another game system or element of 40K that really sort of explores what it's like for the average citizen. And I know gangers are a little bit elevated above that, but it really does kind of allow you to have that like power fantasy of a gang of ne'er-do-wells that are just scraping by, you know, like that film, The Warriors, you know, one gang trying to, you know, make it out alive across the city, and they're ripping pipes off of bathroom walls and, you know, whatever they can get their hands on just to make it through the night and get to the next day. I loved that. I thought that was a fantastic part. And it didn't overwhelm me either as a new player, because that, you know, there wasn't an abundance of stuff to choose from, to the point where it became almost crippling with analysis paralysis, you know, should I take this or should I take that? But also allowed me to find out what worked well for my gang, which was Escher, you know, at that time, and lean into it. And yeah, so that's my strong opinion on it.
I almost completely agree. I mean, I think there's a twofold thing of it. It's the perfect opportunity to play a gang that you've never played before, right? So, I mean, in the last time I did this, I played Corpse Grinder Cult and didn't particularly enjoy playing them, but, you know, never played them. And I think that works relatively well. But equally, I mean, you know, we've talked in the club, you know, Dixie and I have talked for years about this notion of actually sometimes when you get a properly tooled up member of a gang, you look at them and go, you're better equipped than a space marine. That shouldn't probably be right. And this notion of, you know, really, you know, most of the, well, you know, I'd like to think most of the people in the underhive of Necromunda and the other hive cities, you know, Hive Primus, I should say, Necromunda is, people know what I mean. Really are just, you know, I've got like this dodgy auto gun or this, you know, maybe somewhere I've got this like rocket launcher with a missile or something like that. But you know, this notion of I've got a gold plated las cannon and I can, you know, stand at the end of the field and shoot everyone with impunity because I can do da 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 da. And it's like, you're not a space marine and you shouldn't try to be one, kind of thing. And I, the other thing as well is I quite, sometimes, you know, and I'm very, very guilty of those that have listened to episodes of knowing that I've got options in gangs like playing the Redemption and then don't use the House of the Faith points or, you know, whatever. Sometimes I genuinely can't be bothered because it's just, I like, oh, I can't be asked for this. It's too much effort. I'm just here to roll dice and have a good time. And actually campaigns like this make it super easy because it takes away that pressure. And I just go, nah, I've just got some rubbish guys with a couple of auto guns and a pointy stick or whatever analogy, you know, you want. And I don't have to worry and I can be super lazy. It's quite nice.
But how sweet is it when that, you know, one guy with the dodgy sawn off that's, you know, manages to reload and as someone rounds a corner and then he blasts them with knockback into a pitfall or, absolutely, you know, sets them on fire and they run past somebody and then there's a nerve check and, you know.
It's the reason I play the game. I mean, like you said, you know, episode one of GFR, I play the game for Hail Mary moments and really I should. But the thing is, I play the game for Hail Mary moments, but then I don't go out of my way to set up the Hail Mary moments. I just kind of want them to happen organically.
That's the best way, you know. That's where these stories come from that last for ages. At the, you know.
I think the other thing. Well, I think it's a nice break from an arbitration perspective to not have to think about quite so many variations. I mean, you know, the Ash Waste one is a great example because 14 people trying to get their heads around a whole new wealth of vehicle and environment rules, you know, bloody as well as the actual campaign and everything else. It was a mine, lot, mine, a mine, lot going mine. On.
Yeah, mine, 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 mine.
There's a lot going on, but the other thing I've always enjoyed with this particular type of campaign is it brings people who are veteran players of a particular gang, for example, and you see the same builds in those gangs on a regular basis, it forces you to go back to thinking, you know, it's not just about giving that Vansar champion a plasma cannon and pointing him in the general direction of the enemy and with his 2+ to hit roll.
Yeah.
It's about how can you then use that champion if all he's got access to is a stub pistol, for example. Like, you have to go back to the tactical side of what else can I do, rather than just tooling up with the best weaponry in the game. It's a new challenge and it's a refreshing challenge to restrict it in that way and force people to go back to basics and remember about, you know, what Necromunda is actually all about, which is that narrative and that using, you know, ganger number 5 with the stub pistol he's had since he was 12 that's had 6 new barrels and 5 new handles and now he's going to defend half a dome with it on his own, you know. It's that type of stuff.
That's really cool. It's nice to hear, you know, again being relatively kind of new into the system, that we can do something like this and there's enjoyment both sides of the table, metaphorically, which is really cool. You know, rather than you guys feeling as like, well, you know, we need to run a 101 to get everyone up to speed. It's nice to know that there's challenge, and you know, and actually, like you're saying, it's more akin to the actual fluff, right? That's really cool.
But also, like Dixie was just saying, you know, to come off the ash waste, which I'd be interested. Oh, yeah, we should canvas, you know, the enjoyment level. But there are some people, I mean, I really didn't enjoy it. And then there are other people that I think did. But, you know, something like this is almost like a palate cleanser
for them. Yeah, I think there was definitely a mix within the Ashgate campaign of, you know, I think people enjoyed the campaign as a whole and the narrative of the campaign. But there was a lot of confusion and a lot of rules bloat, yeah, and a lot of information to take in very quickly. I mean, that, as I said, I think that first, particularly that first week of the campaign, it's the closest.
It did go to hell in a handbasket rather quickly.
It did. It went very quickly. It's the closest I've coming to taking a step outside for a breath of fresh air at the beginning of a campaign, yeah, than I've had in a long time, because there was just an overload of information in a very short space of time.
Yeah. It was, but
so, but yeah, this will be nice and refreshing because it avoids all of that. It makes it so easy and so simple, and you can just get the tables down, roll some dice. You know, I've put some information in there. There's some recommendations about scenarios, and they are, it's a deliberate mix of Zone Mortalis and Sector Mechanicus, again, to get people used to the way those rules work. But it's things like playing Tunnel Skirmish on Zone Mortalis in week one, and then playing Standoff, which is exactly the same scenario, but in Sector Mechanicus in week two. So, you know, by the time you've played them both, you can see how that works, yeah, and how the different environments interact with each other.
I mean, I have to be honest, Dixie, you know, I'm in the middle of writing my campaign, and there was a notion that we potentially run two, you know, one for the more advanced player and one for the kind of, but actually, I don't think that's a good idea. I think actually having this, everyone play the kind of, not beginner, but like the simplified and just nice and tactically, I don't want to do it disservice by saying simple, but you know what I mean? The this rule set, and then go to do something else. I know it extends our agenda and our sort of schedule of when potential people can do campaigns and all the rest of it, but I kind of really want to play it.
Well, I think it's, I think it'll be good in that way. That's exactly what I've intended it for. You know, it's meant to be that kind of nice and simple, and just concentrate on enjoying the game and not worrying about all of the other stuff that goes alongside it. It's also a very good opportunity for us as a club to learn the changes in the new rules, because obviously
that's a good point.
In the next few days, we will all have to adapt and remember how this all works, and playing a simplified campaign where we don't have to worry about tactics cards and environments and all that stuff, we can concentrate on learning those new rules and how they interact with each other.
Hey, well, can I loop it back really quickly to the conversation we're having around kind of collaboration earlier, you know, and the creative collaboration, is that, you know, what I'm so impressed by is kind of the organic creativity when, you know, at the end of the day, we're kind of moving models and you know, on a table, right? And what I'm fascinated by is the community that, particularly in our club, and I'm sure there's clubs all over the country and all over the world, in fact, that do it, it is actually feeding off of each other's organic creativity of, you know, what that would actually be like in reality, right? You know, what that would actually be like, you know, if you were there. And that, as a new player, that role-playing element and that kind of mental creativity is relatively new. And actually, the fact that we, you know, the new players and veteran players can play together, it is also kind of cognitively teaching us that as well, which is something that, you know, it's not in a rule book, right? And that's a real benefit as well, I think.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah. No, I and that's something I've always really enjoyed about our club in particular, is that those veteran players are very happy to pitch in with new players and will actively help them during the games. You know, again, we've talked about this before, but like, if you're a veteran player and you're playing a new player, and that player does something stupid or doesn't do something obvious because they may not be aware of a particular rule or a particular way something interacts, we don't generally see people just ignoring that and taking it to their advantage to win the game. Mm. They will say, you know, actually, have you considered if you stand up and do this and go over here or press it or open this door, this fighter can then come up and throw a grenade through or whatever it might be. We are very, very good at that. And I think, again, in a campaign like this, where you will then have that interaction much more easily between newer and older players, I think it's very beneficial for everybody. It also gives, you know, having the newer players input into things is refreshing for veteran players just as much as the other way around.
Put me on the same benefactor team as Cal, because I came in with Escher before and I can kind of give him a steer on the Escher side of things.
Well, I've got a question for Cal, actually, looping back to what we were talking about the lore right back at the beginning. But so, Cal, are you now that you know a little bit more about Guildersford and everything that's happened there in the past, are you Team Precinct 19 or are you Team Gangrene?
I like asking someone who they vote for.
Yeah,
it's definitely going to change my opinion of him.
I'm worried,
no votes in Necromunda.
I'm worried about unveiling the veil of mystery here a little bit. I must say. Let's just say I'm still playing in Serpent Stomach Juice. So let's undecided. Undecided.
Too early to tell.
It depends which is most profitable, and I think I'm going to have to grow that. Grow that as I go. I think.
All the mercenary side's coming out already.
Yeah. Ooh. That's it. That's it. As long as I can sell my chems, I'll be happy.
And have you got any sort of fluff already kind of constructed for your gang and how they've come to Guildersford? Or
do you know what? I've got a vision. The way I described it to Dixie was, for those that may have seen it, the second Jurassic Park, and this is going to sound absolutely ridiculous, but in the second Jurassic Park, when the professional hunters are in and they've got all the cages, it's almost like a caravan of dinosaurs they've collected, and all of the trucks, and I've got a caravan-esque vision in my mind of my gang. They carry their wares. They're on the road a little bit. There's some lovely model ideas I've got kind of in mind, and ISO contain, Munitorum container conversion ideas I've got. Again, probably not that original, but a caravan-esque collection of wares and selling that on the road is kind of what I've got in my mind. So
here's where
you've clearly come across one of the Hive guys, Grox caravans.
Oh, yes.
In the past, then.
I was going to say I must have absorbed something up somewhere in the research I've been doing, but yeah, that kind of idea I really like. So
here's where I let the cat out of the bag and say my favorite character of all of the Jurassic Parks is in Jurassic Park 2, and it's not one that most people resonate with, but it's the crazy paleontologist that's stopping and doing the whole full explanation of the dinos. Because I'm a geologist, and it's like, oh, cool! Look, I understand. So he's my favourite character in Jurassic Park.
Love it,
excellent,
love it,
excellent.
So in terms of hobby, then, Cal, have you been? Is that been impacting on what you've been modelling or painting at the moment?
Yeah, do you know what I think? So generally, I've been doing I've been dabbling in 10th actually. I've it couldn't come at a worse but better time, I think, to get into both. And my goodness, 10th edition, 10th edition 40K is just a completely different system altogether, isn't it? And from those that have played 8th and 9th previously, a refreshing change, I think.
It's essentially 5th with a bit of
yeah, absolutely, yeah. So on the Necromunda front, I picked up the gang box and picked up the upgrades box. And actually, again, David from Watford gave me some great advice. He said, don't build your gang too quickly. And the Into the Depth game that we played at the beginning of the week was just a fantastic, so beginning of last week now at the time of recording, was a fantastic way. It was build two models and just fill two models. So actually I've only actually got two built and painted Necromunda models at the moment, and with the Back to Basics campaign coming up, it's quite nice to build for that campaign from a block of sprues, which is quite nice. So I'll have to resist clipping off the mounter gun still to make sure that it's still the bat for basics kind of setup. So yeah, so a bit of
just say it's running very, very low on power and use it as a las gun.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, turn it around and use it as a butt. You know, but yeah, it's So I'll be doing a bit of 40k and trying my hand at some cool color schemes with the Escher gang.
If you want some of the old juves with like the clubs and the stub pistols and auto pistols and that, I've got some of the old metal models.
Tank girl. Lying around.
So hit me up if that's what you're interested in.
Awesome.
Yeah, I've got a few of those as well. I back in the day, going back a very long time now. I was lucky enough to pick up a box of Escher on eBay, metal ones. There was like 150 metal Escher in there because I had grand ideas of making an all-female Imperial Guard army at the time.
Oh, yes,
I remember. Never really got off the ground, so I've still got quite a lot of spare Escher models kicking about.
Says the man with a 3D printer, but anyway, we won't go there.
Well, you know,
I love the phrase that you guys coin about every model is a Necromunda model, and I think you know.
We coined that, but thank you.
No, we didn't. We stole that. Blatantly stole that. That was who was that? That was Carl, wasn't it?
Was it Carl Johnston?
I think so. Yeah,
brilliant. I think that's probably kind of what I've got teed up next. As once I've got kind of the Escher gang together, I've got played around with a bit of scenery. I've got a bit of I bought the Nackmund, some of the Nackmund scenery for 40k, yeah, in the hope that I could, you know, there's some of it if you squint a little bit could be in the Underhive six, yeah, some of the wall segments perhaps maybe
definitely pre-scene 19 kind of fortifications outpost type stuff, right?
Everything will work for that. I've got a whole set of that actually that I am doing up as a pre-scene 19 outpost, so
but what's great about doing the into the depth kind of scenario was, you know, some of the observers and some of the random pundits just on the sidelines watching the gangs go through. So actually I'm gonna get excited by taking a look at some other.
Oh, do you mean the civilian people on the dock side?
Exactly. So that might also, because I've obviously, you know, always tend to go on Citadel miniatures, you know, because of the systems I've played previously. But it'd be nice to kind of pick up some other, you know, other miniatures are available, right? And you know,
absolutely, for sure. There's some great manufacturers out there. I mean, 3D printing aside, you know, I mean, I've used a lot of what are they called, Black Scorpion Wild West miniatures. You know, they make fantastic kind of background characters for Necromunda settlements and things.
Colin the 87 as well.
Colin the 87 is amazing, yeah.
The zombie side stuff's good.
Crooked Dice.
Yeah.
Crooked Dice, that's miniatures. It, yeah.
But talking about miniatures.
Loads of options out there.
Talking about miniatures, I just wanted to, because we talked about this earlier, but I just wanted to say to people, if you haven't seen the new Iron Hand Squat miniature on Forge World, the new one that they're bringing out, I just wanted to point out to everyone, go and watch Final Space if you haven't watched it, and then don't tell me that the little hanger-on doesn't look like Gary. No.
Or go and play Kevin. Deep Rock Galactic.
Deep Rock Galactic.
Yeah.
Was it Molly you said it looks like?
Molly. Yeah.
But yeah, yeah. It just looks like Kevin.
I mean, I'm not an Ironhead player as of yet, but that model's lovely. I think that's a great shout.
I mean, anything that brings more exotic beasts into the game for me.
Well, you're convinced it's going to be a beast.
Just touching very. Sorry?
You're convinced it's going to be a beast, aren't you?
I think it will be. It kind of looks like it should be. But just touching back very briefly on the rules side, the clarifications around exotic beasts are very welcome as part of the new update as well.
Looking forward to getting my head around that.
Yeah, I mean, for my hobby, I mean, I say, as Cal was saying, you know, it's mainly been 10th. I've been trying to finish my Tyranid army, just get it out the way. I'm pretty close to 2,000 points or one version of 2,000 points. I haven't really done any Necromunda. I did 3D print what are they called? The guys with the big...
Neuroflayer thing?
No, the... Oh God, I've completely forgotten the name of it. It's got the big loudspeakers and computer screens.
Agitator.
Noise Marines.
The what? Sorry.
Agitator.
No.
For Necromunda or
For Necromunda.
Propagandist.
Propagandist.
Thank you. That, yes, a complete senior moment there. Propagandist. There's a And I don't even remember. I found it on My Mini Factory. I don't even remember who makes it. I just went,
oh, yes. Is it Ratman Forge?
Yeah, it might be. I genuinely don't remember. I was like, that looks amazing. I'm getting that. And I've got it here, and I need to finish painting it. That's about the only thing I've done in Necromunda. Obviously, the miniatures we used last week for the game, I was using Random Inquisition because I wanted to like Dalaki looking psychers that I didn't have any Dalak ready, so I just picked up a couple of like Random Inquisition-y things that I had knocking around for that. But that's pretty much it for me. Gaz.
Well, life's been really hectic for me over the last 5-6 weeks, so not it very much
has.
I managed to get 3 of my Inquisitor retinue put together, which is loosely linked to Necromunda because it's based around a campaign that we played during COVID through Only War about the Necromunda Eighth. So all of the characters are gangers essentially that have been drafted into the militia and then they've risen up. So I've built 3 of them so far. They might turn up one day, maybe as a Venator or outcast mercenary gang, sort of like the A-Team in our Necromunda campaigns. But we'll wait and see. And then today I ordered some more Vansar models, and along with the, is it Tarantulos Brood, the Warcry models of the spiders. Because my fluff is that they sort of venerate the Wrath Spiders, having had their gang, sort of original gang, decimated by them when they came to Guildersford. So they've sort of started to worship or venerate the spiders and their sort of like hunting style. So I'm going to include a couple of like the spidery bits on some conversions and stuff. So
actually,
I like that idea. They've got too close to Crate Island and went native.
That's exactly it. So they stumbled. They were looking for Archaeotech, come down and stumbled across the Ratskin territory there, and the collapsed dome, went in and were swarmed by spiders. Yeah. And of course, their lasguns being mid to long range kind of didn't help when they were in close quarters, and only the ones with the sort of like the shotguns, the pistols and stuff, you know, and the shields kind of survived. And so then from that, they've kind of changed their sort of mantra and their style. So they're a predominantly close quarters gang and kind of lean into maybe some different weaponry to what Vansar are perhaps commonly associated with.
I'd completely missed that. I hadn't even seen that. They are really nice. I like those models.
Oh, what, the Tarantulos Brood?
Yeah, I completely missed those.
And I'm quite looking forward to and I went with a lot of cyber arachnids in my initial gang build for them when I ran them in the Haunter in the Dark campaign. So I'm hoping to add some exotic beasties in there as the game progresses.
Cool.
Dixie, I've been still on my kind of historical rabbit hole. I've been 3D printing. I've following a conversation with another wargaming friend of mine. We've gone into an emu war spiral. If you don't know about the emu war, Google it. It is hilarious. 1930s Australia. Australia declared war on the emus and lost, basically. So I've been 3D printing 28mm emus and working on some stuff for that, which is going to be very, very silly, but very entertaining.
We have quite a large number of Australian listeners, and I would love to know what they think of that one.
I think it'll be yes. I've got my 28mm Australian miniatures have just turned up today, so I'm looking forward to getting some paint on those at some point. Necromunda wise, I have been primarily not modelling as such, but working on the books and the lore and various bits and pieces. So yes, I'm still sort of plinking away on that. The campaign pack, our own lore book, and I've got several other bits and pieces in the pipeline as well, which we'll cover in a future episode.
Fantastic. Well, I think we've spoken for long enough and we've taken up too much of your precious time, listeners. So thanks very much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the episode. And if you didn't, but you've listened this far, we thank you for listening as long as you have. Have a great month gaming, and that's bye from me.
Cheerio.
Sayonara.
Goodbye.
Take it easy, guys. Have a great month. Bye.
You've been listening to Guildersford Radio, broadcasting live all across the Sump, the Hive, Outlands, and the far reaches of the Ash Waste.